This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You may know him as the Wonder Dog.
He is a true horse.
But to us, he's just good old Uncle Hud. It's time for Royals broadcaster and friend of the show, Rex Hudler, to join the drive.
Very happy to be joined by friend of the show, friend of the station, and friend to us all, Rex Hudler, Royals television broadcaster, joining us today on the show. Hud, you there?
What a question, C-Dot. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing good, Hud. I don't know if you guys are going to play today. It is raining hard outside right now.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to predict. You know, I know Milwaukee doesn't exactly want to come back or stay over the off day. I don't know if they have an off day tomorrow. I had to look there, but... You know, there's a lot of things that you can't control in this business, and rain and weather is one of them.
Absolutely. Hud, whenever you played baseball, what were some of the things you guys did to pass the time during rain delays?
Oh, man, you know what? Cards were big. You know, I never was a card player because the advice I got when I was a young ball player from some ex-players were to stay out of the card games and stay out of the back of the bus. And so I kind of kept to those for the most part. They played cards. Back then, you know, we would pitch quarters. You know, depending on how the delay was, we'd get a pocket full of quarters. And, you know, these guys are highly competitive guys. So they'll compete over anything, nickels, quarters, whatever you got. And so card games. And, you know, sporting news, we read stuff. We didn't have phones. We didn't have stuff like that. There was a few board games and things, but mainly guys just entertained themselves with cards.
Hud, you talk about the competitiveness. You obviously got to be super competitive to make it to the level of baseball that you did and have the success that you had for as long as you did. Who was the most competitive guy that you played with or were around?
Man, that's a tough question, C-Dot. Man, I think, you know, Ozzie Smith was I know. Speaking of shortstops, Cal Ripken Jr. by far. He competed in everything, and I was so thankful I got a chance to play for any team that would take me. But number one, the Orioles were a wonderful stop. It was a two-year stop for me, couple cups of coffee in the majors. But I got to hang out with Cal and Eddie Murray and some of the Freddie Lynn and a few of those guys. But Cal Ripken, I remember being in the Metrodome. And in the Metrodome, it was an indoor facility. From the field to the locker rooms, you had to go up about 50 or 60 flights of stairs to get up there. I remember going up one time and with Cal, and Cal looks at me at the bottom of the stairs, and it's on. Is it on, Hud? And he raced me up the stairs. And here, I'm going to be riding the pine for nine. Here's the Iron Man playing every single day for over 4,000 games in a row, whatever, and he wanted to race me up for a meaningless challenge to beat me up the stairs. I mean, that just blew me away. That, you know, the guy's not going to get hurt. You're not going to break him, but it just was very impressive how competitive he was at that. And we played tape ball in the locker room late. Tape ball, you know, that's with a wiffle ball, or a little taped-up ball with athletic tape and wiffle balls. And bats, and we would compete there and try to win, try to beat guys. I mean, everything was about beating your opponent. It was crazy.
Right now, we're talking to Royals television broadcaster Rex Hudler. I know that yesterday wasn't Kane's first time back in Kansas City, but how cool was it to see him get that ovation and then be embraced by Salvador Perez?
Oh man, it was great. Hey, and we caught some exchange too during the little 20-minute rain delay of Lorenzo Cain and Salvi from each dugout across the field, bantering to one another and talking smack and smiling and laughing. And it was fun. It's really great whenever we have some downtime like that, so me and Ryan can fill and we can just talk about different subjects and things on the air. So that's what's good about that. But we caught them doing that in between the, too. Very fresh. The memories that the fans have for their championship players will never go away. We can't wait to see Moose and Haas back, and you know some of the guys that were an integral part of that team. Those teams.
Hud, what makes that group so fun to me is like they didn't have that one sort of key figure. Like you talk about playing with Ozzie Smith, how he was the wizard. I'm sure he was the most popular Cardinal, or Cal Ripken Jr., where the 14 and 15 Royals had like five or six players that different parts of the city, different people, different demographic and ages all loved equally, whether it was Haas or Moose or Kane or Salvi, where they just had a great group of about six people that this city really embraced.
Yeah, you know, and every franchise has those, and that's what the importance, you know, of baseball, that we can rejoice and celebrate those players, and that's a huge thing, you know, for me, getting to be there in 02 when I was broadcasting with the Angels, their only world championship there in 02. I mean, Tim Salmon, Troy Gloss, Benji Molina, Darren Erstad. Those guys will never be forgotten in that part of the country. And so it's the same way here. So a real privilege for me to be able to travel around, live in different cities, and get to meet different people. It's been a huge blessing, C-Dot.
Right now we're talking to Rex Hudler. Hud, yesterday Chris Bubich was absolutely fantastic. What's it like to see him kind of put these quality starts together?
Wow, for a kid to mature overnight like that, this is what we're going to see with the rest of them. I loved his composure. Now, towards the end a little bit, when he walked the batter, he started getting a little flustered. You could see he was a little frustrated. He kind of hopped up, jumped off, said a few words a few times, jumped off the mound. You know, he'll polish that out of his game as well. I could see him hopefully someday being like a Mark Burley, a guy that just has great tempo, attacks hitters, never is emotionless, never shows any emotion the whole time he's out there. We're seeing a future rotation piece of the Royals for a long time to come. I think he understands who he is. He's not out there trying to throw 98 when he has 94. He might have a little 95 in it, but he's good in the low 90s, 93. But when you have a changeup that you can throw any time, then that's an equalizer to lefties or righties. And I was very impressed with him and have been all season long. It's like he flipped the switch on, and that's the switch that we'll be looking for some of his other buddies that are in AAA right now.
Hud, because right now, if I had to say you could just magically fix one thing for this team, I would fix they just need to get more innings out of their starters. I know that the game has changed from where you played, where you're not going to have those workhorses eating up 7-8 innings at a time, but this rotation just has to go deeper in ball games to sort of give this bullpen a breather.
Yeah, I would agree with you, C-Dot. And I think that they're heading in that direction. And we already saw a clean defense. The defense has played much better. They've cleaned a lot of stuff up. And it's going to continue to improve when Mondesi joins them, whenever that'll be. They'll put Nicky, I'm sure, back at second, and Witt will go out to right. And there's an upgrade right there with speed for Witt out there in the outfield to cover some ground, along with Michael A. Taylor, who's a plus three runs in defensive run save. That's right up there at the top in the American League for coverage for center fielders. So the metrics are making him look good. But Benintendi, he's got no trouble in left. And then once Mondesi gets there, they're going to get Dozier back at third base. And I think, you know, it'll take him another 2-3 weeks, a month, to settle in. But what's weird is looking at the numbers of the players now and seeing the amount of games it's played. Last year, heck, we were two-thirds of the way through the season. And now it just reminds me, looking at the numbers, I'm like, man, this is so early in the season. We got so much time left. So that's the good thing about the Royals. There are three areas in the game that you have to have success and consistency in to win. That's good pitching, good defense. Those two go hand in hand, one and two. And then number three, the timely hits. You got to have those. And so they haven't gotten together in all three of those categories yet very consistently, but they're getting there. You can see it's going to happen. And when it does, this team is a 500 or better team. They're better. They could surprise some people depending on their rotation, who gets in there. I think the fact that Duffy is just a little nicked, the way he called it, that's really a good thing because we'll have him back. I think it's just a matter of time, but I enjoy the product. We lead the league in steals, and we're not even trying. We don't have Mondesi. Mondesi will steal six bases in a week when he's right. And we hope that he's getting right now. So a lot of good things to come, C-Dot. I just can't wait to get to the ballpark tonight. And hopefully that rain will stop and they'll be able to get it in.
Hud, I know you're all about the people. How excited are you to be back at full capacity? I know it has been a long time since we've seen a full, packed, energetic Kauffman Stadium. But you would think that first game on a holiday, you would assume that it's going to be a pretty lively crowd to come out and see this team.
Oh, no doubt. What a difference. I even made a comment at the end of the game when my outstanding partner gives me an opportunity to have the last word. Well, Hutt, what's your thoughts? And I had many, but I ended on the fans being back make the whole difference. It's just a beautiful thing to watch fans make catches in the stands, even when they miss. To see the children with their parents in the stands, I get my heart is warmed. There were times I got emotional just watching the fans and watching the fun they have back at the K. Such a beautiful ballpark, and they are the game. The fans are our game. Now, certainly you have to have players to go see, but you know, what we saw last year for the first time in our life and hope we've never seen it again, fans that weren't there, and man, was it a dull game.
Hud, last question here. You played during an era in which there wasn't replay, and we've seen the evolution of instant replay. How are you, as someone who played the game and followed it, how are you happy with replay? Because I sort of look at the sport, and baseball for the longest time was sort of, we don't want replay, we don't want replay. And now that we have it, I really question if it's actually making the product on the field better.
Yeah, you know, when Joe Torre, 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago, before it started, we always have a broadcast meeting with all the broadcasters in baseball in the majors. We have it out in Los Angeles, and it's a big seminar. In Major League Baseball, they always have a representative there to share with us broadcasters what to expect for the upcoming season. And when Joe Torre made the announcement that we were going to have replay this year, he made sure to say that we were going to hope our goal is to try to get the call right at the end of the night when we go home. And he said it's going to take us 3, 4, maybe 5 years to tweak this thing to get it to where we want it. So it's, even at that time, Master Joe Torre, he knew that there would be some glitches, there would be some things that was going to happen. So they warned us then that it was going to take time, and that's what it is. We'll just have to hang with it and see. They'll continue to make improvements, we hope, for the better of the game, and that's the bottom line. It is interesting, you know, to see these calls. And so and now Ryan and I, when we're in between, we're thinking, well, it looks like, well, you can throw that out because it looks like, or he was safe. You know, it's interesting. It makes for a little bit of banter. But what's going to happen next year, and I'm sure that Major League Baseball will incorporate this, is give the umpires the field microphone and let us hear what they're doing, what they're replaying, what it is, so we can continue to be educated about the grand game. That's going to be a huge element coming. And I was on with Major League Baseball earlier this year, and they asked anybody for questions, and I said, hey, when are you going to give the umpires the field mic? And they were going to do it last year before the pandemic hit, and they said it's coming soon. So they're already going to implement that, and I think that's going to be another big improvement for our fans.
And that is Rex Hudler, Royals television broadcaster, joining us on the show today as the Royals officially crossed the 40-game mark.
C-Dot, hold on 1 second. I heard you talking earlier about La Russa and stuff. And, you know, I am not an advocate, if I ever was a manager, to make anything public before I didn't address it with my team. But he missed the sign. La Russa gave him the take sign. He didn't want him to swing 3-0. That was the issue. I think it just got a little blown out and carried away. But, you know, you miss a sign, you know, your manager usually finds you, takes care of that behind the scenes and doesn't make it public. So that was the issue. But still, I don't agree with La Russa how he did that. He actually hurt his team with that type of stuff. So, you know, if you're a manager, you got to be really careful.
That is Rex Hudler joining us on the show today. Thanks, Hud.
Hey, C-Dog, I appreciate it, buddy. See you next week.
Absolutely. That's Royals television broadcaster Rex Hudler joining us on the show today. My apologies. I wasn't quick enough with the button. Coming up next, we're very happy to be joined by former Chiefs offensive lineman Mitchell Schwartz will join us in studio. That's next. Keep it locked in right here. It's The Drive.
The Drive, weekdays 2 to 6. Welcome back to 610 Sports Radio, the official broadcast partner of the Kansas City Chiefs.
Right now, we are very happy to be joined in studio by, we have a rule, if you come on the show three times, you become friend of the show. You are now officially friend of the show, Mitchell Schwartz, joining us in studio for the remainder of the hour. How you doing?
I'm doing well. You know, I don't have too many friends, so that's pushing my numbers up by a pretty large percentage. I'll take it.
Next, we're going to start cooking together, and then we're going to that wedding. That's what I'm planning on. We're going to end up doing those things. So last week when you came in, I said that I wanted to get your Andy Reid stories of what do you think makes him so great. I don't know, have you been keeping up with this White Sox thing, with the unwritten rules and all that kind of stuff? But I was thinking to myself, Andy Reid would never put you guys in that situation. Even if you publicly did something or a player did something publicly, I think he would give like a non-answer and then it might get addressed to the team or addressed privately with the player. I can't think of a scenario in which Andy has sort of left one of you guys out there to dry.
I don't think he ever has in terms of talking to the media. You know, he'll say whatever he needs to make sure that, like you said, kind of give a non-answer, talk around things. But if something happens, he'll address it with us directly. You know, I think that's one of the things that makes him so awesome to play for is, you know, you're not going to get embarrassed in the media. You're not going to have your name thrown out there in a negative light. Like I said, I mean, he definitely holds guys accountable. There's plenty of times where he needs to talk to people or bring them in or do whatever, but he does it, you know, fairly face-to-face. He doesn't have too many rules. I think that's another thing that makes it so fun to play for. But the rules that he does have, you know, he is strict about because there just aren't too many. And so it's mostly, you know, being a good person, being a good teammate, not stealing, you know, simple stuff like that. I mean, those are literally like his main rules.
So you've played in a different city. You've had different head coaches. You've been in different environments, different offensive coordinators. What is it about Andy Reid that you think makes him so great? Like when Andy's done, he's going to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. What is it about Andy that you think makes him the figure in the NFL that he is?
Well, I think it's, you know, as a head coach, his relatability to his players. You know, he knows how to coach us. He knows how to get the most out of us. You know, I think any great teacher understands how to properly interact with an individual and teach them the right way. I mean, if you just want to talk about an offensive lineman specifically, you know, some guys like to study the playbook directly and see everything on paper. Some guys look at, you know, every single drawing and memorize all those. You know, some guys only watch film. Some guys need to walk through things or practice them. So there's, you know, four or five different ways to learn. And a coach's responsibility is to understand how best, you know, his individual players learn and coach them properly. So there's that aspect. And I think, you know, as the head coach, especially motivationally, knowing, you know, which guys you need to kind of give that kick to, which guys need a little feistiness from you, which you need to kind of let do their own thing. So it's balancing all those things. And, you know, during training camp, he's got 90 different guys to do that with. And then on the offensive side of things, we all know that he's, you know, an offensive genius and he designs these plays and these playbooks and he's always had success. But I think it's a deeper level of understanding than, you know, a traditional coordinator. I mean, we see every season there's these, you know, few plays that take the league by storm. You know, a few years ago, it was that one particular screen. You know, we ran a bunch, the Rams ran a bunch, but you fake this, you fake that, you fake this, and come back and dump it off to the running back, and then all of a sudden the league starts running it. Well, everyone's running it because they've seen a couple teams use it and it's successful, and oh, it works against the cover three defense, so we'll run it against, you know, Seattle and Jacksonville and these other cover three teams. Where I think coach is able to know what the defense is doing, understand how they work, you know, design things to specifically attack them and attack weaknesses. And that's just not that higher level of thinking that, you know, many other guys can get to. I mean, there's probably 3 to 5 guys who are at that level where they're so well-versed in what the defense is doing, what the other team's doing, that they can look to create things to attack, you know, weaknesses. I think, you know, most coordinators know what they've been taught. They know, oh, against this look, this play is supposed to work. Or a couple of weeks ago, this team ran it, it worked, so we're going to run it, it's going to work. But coach is always pushing the boundaries. He's creating things. He's making new things happen. And that's where, you know, his true offensive genius comes from.
I remember listening to, it was like some E60 or whatever, and I think it was Martellus Bennett, how he was talking about how he played for all these different organizations and how when he went to New England, it was the first time that he felt, I know exactly what the team expects of me. I know exactly what the head coach expects of me. So as long as I do that, I won't have any problems. I feel like Reed does a really good balance of sort of creating that environment where you can be yourself. But also, it also seems like all of you know what your expectations or role is on any given play, any single scenario, every time you go out there to play.
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. I mean, you know how you work in that play. You know, when we install things or teach them or coach them, you know, it is a very holistic thing where, you know, I know what I'm supposed to do, but I also have, you know, somewhat of an understanding of what Pat's looking at, what, you know, Trav is looking at in the secondary, you know, what these other guys are doing. And so when you kind of take yourself out from just looking at yourself and, you know, oh, how do I play right tackle? And you can take a more holistic view. It's also easier to do that when you're coached that way and when, you know, you're getting this information that's more, you know, broad than just what, you know, your position is looking at. So there's that. There's, like you said, the expectations. You know, you definitely know what's expected of you, what's required of you, all those things. And then I think, you know, as well, coach doesn't want to have to get on guys every day. He doesn't want to have to coach people who are difficult. And so I think the Chiefs organization does a great job of bringing players in who, you know, fit the mold of being smart, being motivated, you know, understanding the game, and coach can just kind of let them loose. And then, you know, if things flare up here and there, there's really good leaders on the team to take care of it. You know, there's not too many times he really has to jump in because they've hired the right people. They've brought in the right guys. They've built the right culture that it kind of just runs itself.
Right now we're talking to Mitchell Schwartz joining us in studio for the rest of the 4 o'clock hour. I looked this up. So Andy is coached now 22 years, 15 of those years, he has had a double digit win season. You know, that's not normal. How hard is it to accomplish what Andy has done in the NFL, where basically if that's your coach, regardless of quarterback, regardless of offensive skill position players, defense, any of those things, you're going to win at least 9 or 10 games every single year.
Yeah, the crazy part of that is the expectation that he's going to do it. You know, we talked last week that he's, you know, hit over the win total, Vegas recommendations for each year with the Chiefs, and you said something like 17-3 career or whatever it is. But it's a whole different ballgame when people are expecting you to be good. You know, we obviously have run into that the past few years, especially with Pat. You know, the expectations of, oh, you should be the best offense in the NFL, you should be the best team, you should win the Super Bowl, this and that. That's a whole different ballgame than, you know, being in Cleveland and, you know, being 5-11 every year and, you know, going up to Baltimore and they'll maybe take you serious in the second half when, you know, you've got a 3-point lead and then they'll turn it on and, you know, kind of blow you out. And so that's something that, you know, people don't really appreciate, I think, is when a team's good and they're supposed to be good, it's way more difficult to maintain that and to stay good because, you know, there is that just component of human nature that if, you know, you're going against a team who's not supposed to be as good, you know, maybe you don't try quite as hard, maybe you don't practice quite as hard. That just happens. I'd like to say that it doesn't happen, but, you know, you see it, you know, year to year. They call them trap games for a reason. You know, teams are looking past a specific opponent for someone down the road.
Those are real? Like, I just want you to confirm this is real.
I personally don't believe in them because that's not the way I operate. I will say there does seem to be, I don't think it's that you look at the opponent and kind of stick your nose up at them and say, okay, you know, we're going to smash them and it's not going to be a big thing. I think it's complacency with your own success. I think that's much more, you know, applicable to the quote unquote trap game than anything. It's that, you know, you're going against this team, you're supposed to win, you've been playing well, you know, the team's cruising, you're tired, you're beat up, and, you know, maybe I don't want to run quite as fast on Wednesday and Thursday, or maybe I don't want to block quite as hard on Wednesday, Thursday, and then those things creep into the game on Sunday. I think that is very real. I think, you know, there's probably some scientific study out there on the trap games, and I think there is that human element to it. And so, yeah, I mean, getting back to the original question, it's much more difficult to be successful and stay successful and do it year after year. And so what coach has been able to do in two different cities, let alone, is pretty special.
I just always thought, like, with the trap game, like, you guys are real people. That, like, you know the schedule. Like, you know, all right, we have these two teams coming up, and then on the back end, we play at Baltimore. You know how important that game is in the standings and what it means for you to win that game. So to me, it's like normal behavior to, all right, our preparation, like you said, we're not going to go as hard in this practice. But I also would imagine you also can feel that extra added motivation, like this week is sharper in practice because we know we're going on the road to play Buffalo and how important this game is.
Yeah, that's a key thing that you mentioned. Is it's not necessarily that we're looking ahead and saying, oh, we got Baltimore next week. It's a Monday night game. You know, I need to make sure to save my energy this week to be good for it. It's more that, you know, that specific week, okay, it's a Monday night game. We're playing Baltimore. They're a great team. We're going on the road. All these things kind of combine to make sure that you're sharp, make sure that you're practicing hard, kind of give you that extra motivation to make sure you're staying the course. Where if you're playing the 3-12 team late in December, your body doesn't feel great. You know, you're already 13-2, or I guess you're already, you know, let's say 12-1. You know, maybe, okay, this is the week that, you know, I'm just going to take it a little bit easier in practice. You know, it's not because next week is that big game. It's just because that particular week you feel like, okay, we're playing well. I got this. I'm tired. I don't think it's looking forward the week and saying, all right, we got a tough one next week. I need to pace myself for it. I think it's very much an in the week thing that the human nature kind of takes over.
Right now we're talking to Mitchell Schwartz. What's harder? Is it harder playing in an empty stadium like you guys did last year, or playing when it's 80,000 on the road screaming against you? Because at least like your body's accustomed to going into those environments. You played major college football. You played in the NFL for a long time. Like, when's the last time you played in front of zero people? You did that week two against the Chargers. Like, you go on the road, there's nobody in the stands. What was harder, playing with nobody or playing with everybody?
Oh, that for sure. That was just odd. I'm not sure if it's harder because there's that energy that gets brought to the table that you're used to, that you kind of crave and that gets things going, or just because it's so different from everything else you've ever done and every other game you've played. I mean, even high school, my high school team sucked. You know, I won 9 career games in 3 years in high school, but we still had a few hundred fans, you know, still had parents screaming and, you know, cheering, and there was some noise, there was some energy level and excitement. So the weirdness of it, the lack of energy, you know, there's that huge hit with what Damian and Herbert on the other sideline, and you can just straight up hear it for one, which is odd to hear a hit, you know, from 70 yards away. And two, like, you're sitting on the bench and you just kind of get used to hearing the crowd and, oh, okay, then, you know, that they converted on third down, so we don't have to get up and go on the field. Or, you know, on the field, oh, I'm blocking, and all of a sudden I hear something like, oh, they caught the ball downfield. I can start running downfield. You just don't get any of those cues. You don't know what's going on. It's really weird. I remember it might have even been the first play of the game. You know, we ran the ball. I was blocking Ingram. We were like 15, 20 yards downfield, just kind of going towards the play. And I was like, dude, this is weird. I've never seen anything, felt anything like this. He's like, yeah, this is odd. So I think it's just so different and so strange that, you know, really took guys out of their element and, you know, I think probably led to worse football, at least early on, while people adapted.
So speaking of that Chargers game, I know this doesn't affect you as much. When did you realize that Herbert was going into the game? Like, I remember in Twitter, it was, well, they're starting Herbert. It's like, well, hold on. Like, it's week two. Tyrod Taylor didn't do anything to get benched. Then you find out he's playing. Then you find out why he's not playing the game. Like, how does that information kind of flow to you guys on a game day?
I did not know until maybe the second or third play of the game where I looked out and I saw Herbert out there. I was like, wait, are they running like a weird play? Why isn't Tyrod in? And we were just trying to figure it out because we didn't get that information. I mean, I think, you know, legally you're not supposed to look at your phone or be on social media at a certain point before game anyway. But I had no idea. You know, I saw Herbert out there. You know, I keep up on social media, on news and stuff. I knew he wasn't supposed to be starting that game. I don't know if it was a late switch. I didn't know what was happening. You know, he started playing. He kept playing. I think people were saying, you know, Tyrod wasn't out there and it's going to be Herbert. And it's just like, okay, I guess he's playing. But yeah, I didn't know until a few plays in, once I kind of realized, like, oh, that's not the guy that's supposed to be out there.
Given the situation, I actually thought Herbert played pretty well. Like, finding out that you were going to start that day, that's your first career start, you're going against the Super Bowl champion Kansas City Chiefs. Like, given the situation, I thought Herbert played well.
Yeah, he played awesome. I mean, they almost beat us, and, you know, they probably should, looking back on, you know, how we played. Yeah, he played awesome. I mean, he had a really good rookie year. You know, not great for the Chiefs that, you know, he turned out to be a pretty good pick. But, yeah, I thought he did a great job. I think it also is a little bit funny and kind of puts a damper on the whole, like, oh, you got to change systems because the quarterback's different and this and that. And it's like, he wasn't even prepared. He didn't know he was playing. You know, you just go out there, you ball, you do your thing.
So you bring up trap game. Not going to ask you all my questions that, like, we sports people talk about, like, hey, it's a trap game, or that's bulletin board material. Is there a such thing as bulletin board material? Like, let's say I say something on the radio. It gets to one of the players and, like, Andy, like, shares that with you guys, or Stephen A. Smith. Like, is there a real thing as bulletin board material in the locker room?
I would say it depends guy to guy. I'm not someone that, you know, needs that external motivation. You know, my motivation comes from really like fear of failure and worrying about getting the quarterback killed or the running back killed. You know, so I'm pretty internally motivated, and I don't necessarily think, oh, well, this defensive lineman bashed us, so I'm going to, you know, play harder, do whatever. Some guys really use that. You know, for some guys, that's absolutely a thing. And, you know, coach, maybe once or twice a year, he'll mention something's floating around in the media or something's happening that, hey, just so you guys know, you know, this is going on. So it does happen every now and again. You know, he definitely does not, you know, go to that well too often. I don't think, you know, that's a thing that you can use every single week or too much. But it works for some guys, and, you know, some guys kind of need that external fuel to get it going. So the bulletin board material thing, you know, is something that exists. You know, I think we saw it in the playoffs last year with, you know, Steelers and Juju and what he said, and that seemed to, you know, actually really ignite the Browns and, you know, kind of propel them there.
What's it like to live a life in which people openly discuss how much money you make? Like, I was thinking that with Tyrann Mathieu, because there's conversations if he's going to extend his contract. You know, I'm looking at it like, all right, well, Justin Simmons got this, so you should be getting this, or no, I don't think it's worth that. Like, you guys live one of the only few jobs where people know exactly how much you make, when you're going to get X number of dollars. What's it like to live a life where that information's so public?
Well, you just get used to it, I'd say. You know, it's public knowledge. It's out there. It kind of makes things easier when you're talking to people just in general, because, you know, it's not this, oh, how much does he make? What does he make? You know, you kind of know. Even if they don't know specifics, like, oh, he makes a lot of money, he makes a little bit of money, and kind of all these things. So in some ways, it's weird because people know your finances. In another way, it's can be helpful at times because people just know that, you know, it doesn't have to be so hidden, because, you know, money is one of those kind of taboo things that typically you don't want to discuss. I will say the one thing that, you know, kind of universally sucks for everyone, you know, athlete-wise, or people who make, you know, celebrities, whatever else, who makes money, is, especially for us, you know, that's not the money that we have in our bank account. You know,
I was just going to say that, because, like, you got to your second contract, so, like, you cashed in an NFL sense. But, like, there's some guys on the team, they're in their third year, but they're still on that, you know, mid-round rookie deal. Like, you've made good money for a regular person, but compared to what I think fans think that athlete has, it's not close.
Yeah, and it is more the second contracts, because those are the ones – they get reported, although these days apparently every single person who got drafted that signs, you know, their initial contract, it gets reported, which doesn't make any sense to me. I guess we're just all bored out there. But the second contract where, you know, oh, Tyrann signed 3 years, $42 million, you know, all these things. Well, that doesn't mean he has $42 million. You know, that means the first year he's going to make a third of that, and he's going to lose half of that to taxes and all these other things. And so that's the part where people just assume, oh, you got $40 million. It's like, no, you don't. You have, you know,
$16 million.
Yeah, and then the government and whoever else takes half of that, and you really have eight. And now, yeah, that's fantastic. You know, that's obviously a ton of money. That's more than most people will make in their lives, and it's awesome. But, you know, some people just kind of say, oh, you know, you got $40 million. You know, it's like, no, you don't. It's just, it's the way those things work in reality is a little bit different. And obviously, we're all very blessed to be in this situation. But I think that's the biggest misconception, is, you know, how that money gets paid, how it gets taxed, and the fact that it's not guaranteed that we're most likely not going to make all the money that's reported.
What's it like to see the first bank account where all that money gets deposited? Like, you don't seem like the guy that went to go buy a chain or a new Ferrari. Like, I'm sure you made like a wise financial investment, but there has to be that kind of ticker shock of, oh my goodness, like, they just gave me all this amount of money to keep doing what I love to do.
Yeah, it's pretty nuts. It's a good feeling. You know, that's definitely one of the perks of what we do. You know, so being able to kind of see it in, you know, the form of it being on a check and depositing it and seeing it in your account, it's pretty cool. It's a good feeling. It's, you know, there's not too many things that you can get validation from in the NFL world. I mean, there's Super Bowl ring, there's, you know, Pro Bowl, All Pro, and your contract. And, you know, it's really, that's about it. And so, you know, how much you get paid really is a validation of kind of your worth and, you know, how good of a player you are and all these things. So in a weird way, it's, you know, just further validation that, hey, I'm doing this right. Things are working out. All the hard work has been worth it.
Right now we're talking to Mitchell Schwartz. Coming up in a little bit, we'll let you ask him some questions. Hashtag Ask Mitch, 913-576-7610. You play in probably the most hyper-aggressive competitive field that anybody can join. Who do you think is the most competitive guy on the team?
Oh, Pat. That one's pretty easy. It doesn't matter what it is. I mean, it could be some stupid game guys are playing in the locker room. It could be, I mean, golf. We've seen him, you know, do the thing with Coors Light where he's trying to hit the ball over the mountains. And, you know, every single thing he does, he wants to be the best at. And obviously it's winning and it's, you know, being successful there. But it's just this desire to be great in every single aspect of what he does. And so that's part of what makes him such a good leader is, you know, you see that guy who's got all these accolades. He's young. He's got a ton of money and great life, all these things. And he's still working super hard and he's still, you know, as frustrated at himself as anybody because he's got these expectations and this competitiveness. It's a pretty cool thing to see.
How is that growth process? Because he's not a starter initially. Alex is the starter. They then say, hey, you're our starting quarterback. But I don't know if that instantly day one makes you the leader of the team. It seems like kind of a hierarchy, something you have to grow into. How is that kind of seeing that process for him? For now, he is the guy breaking down the huddle. He is sort of the vocal leader of the team. What was that process like?
It was very easy. That's something that I think he's just got that, you know, quote unquote it factor or that natural ability to lead. I think that might be one of the rare areas that, you know, his dad growing up, you know, being a pro athlete and being around other athletes and being in locker rooms, I think that's an area where it actually might have helped him and, you know, really did advance and knowing kind of dynamics of, you know, the guy that's in charge and how to properly lead, how to break down a team, all these things. You know, that kind of snippet of him playing baseball, his dad growing up playing baseball, gets thrown out an absolute lot. But I do think, you know, maybe that's a reason why he's that way. I'm sure there's some other, you know, factors and reasons, but it was easy. I mean, he just started breaking the team down. It didn't seem like there's anything to it. You know, he's given pregame speeches. He's given hype up speeches. If, you know, we're not playing well at halftime, he's firing guys up. You know, none of that has ever been felt forced, even that first year. You know, it's also kind of a cool situation. Like you said, Alex was a starter. He was the backup. You know, he wasn't trying to jump in, breaking down the team and, you know, trying to like assert himself and needing to be the guy. So he's got that, you know, awareness of the situation and his surroundings and, you know, combined with that natural leadership ability. It was seamless. And, you know, that was probably the most impressive thing from his, you know, second year, aside from the 50 touchdowns and the 5,000 yards.
What goes into halftime? Because, like, I think fans have this perception of you go into the locker room, the coach is sitting there on the board, he draws up these magical adjustments that are going to turn the first half around and bring you a win in the second half. What goes on during halftime?
A lot of guys go pee. That's usually the first thing is guys run to the bathroom and, you know, do that. You know, the coaches have to talk to each other about what they want to talk about, you know, to us. So there's kind of that 5-minute period where we go in, you know, do what you need to do in the bathroom or whatever else, grab some food. You know, guys will eat. There's snacks, oranges, whatever else, hydration stuff, you know, protein, whatever guys need. That's typically the time to do it. You kind of drink and sip and snack on stuff throughout. But the coaches come back out. You know, you usually break up with your position coach. I mean, typically the O-line coach comes out and starts talking to the O-line and says, all right, they're doing this stuff. You know, we've already talked about it because, you know, you talk about stuff, you know, every drive after you come off the field. But this is what they're doing. This is what we like, you know, coming out. We like these few plays. We like these passes, these runs. This is what we think we're going to get from them. You know, oh, they haven't blitzed too much, but we're up by a couple scores. You know, expect them to get more aggressive. Maybe they'll drop a couple things if there's something that's completely different or if there's something that was causing us frustration or, you know, causing us to not be on point. But for the most part, it's just kind of listing those things, talking it through. That lasts, you know, 3, 4, 5 minutes. It's not too long. I mean, our half times are, I don't know what, like 14 minutes. So by the time you get back in, go to the bathroom, whatever else, you only got 8 minutes left. So when they come back out, I mean, they only have 3 or 4 minutes to really talk to you. So, yeah, it's not quite like they, you know, describe it in movies and, you know, other places. But there are adjustments being made. There are, hey, this might happen. This could happen. This is what's happened. And this is what we expect.
Right now, we're talking to Mitchell Schwartz. He joins us in studio. If you got a question for him, 913-576-7610. We'll do Ask Mitch next. Keep it locked in right here. It's The Drive.
The Drive, 610 Sports Radio. Welcome back to 610 Sports Radio, the official broadcast partner of the Kansas City Chiefs.
All right, so we'll get to your questions here momentarily. Mitchell Schwartz is in studio, 913-576-7610. So we have had a couple of debates on the show over the last couple of days. Do you use mayonnaise on your grilled cheese sandwiches instead of butter? I had no clue this was a thing that people did. Blew my mind.
I've used both. I think if you want to kind of do the pro move, you do a little bit of a combo where do a very light, you know, mayo schmear on the outside, and then you've also got some melted butter in the pan that kind of tells you, you know, when the pan's ready, and also kind of fills in the cracks that maybe the mayo doesn't get to. So, you know, I tend to like the flavor of butter better. I think people argue that the spreading of the mayo and then, you know, putting that on the griddle gets a more complete, you know, kind of browning. So to me, why don't you just combine the two and then you get browning and flavor?
So earlier today we did what are tier one breakfast foods? Like, what are the elite quarterback breakfast foods? I said eggs, bacon, pancakes, French toast, and omelets. Is there anything that you would remove from tier one? Anything you would add to tier one?
I think hash browns have to be in there.
That's what Rob was saying.
Yeah, you got to have a potato in there, especially a fried one. To me, I think it's eggs, bacon, orange juice, coffee, hash browns. Maybe like a good piece of sourdough bread, toasted, some butter. I think that is kind of your standard. Like if you go to IHOP, I mean, and you get scrambled eggs, bacon, side of toast, coffee, orange juice, hash browns. Like, that's your order. You can get that every time and be happy. So to me, those are kind of the tier one staples.
My only issue with putting hash browns in the tier one is hash browns normally come with one of those things. Like, that's the main course. And then the hash browns are like the entree. Like, you get pancakes with the side of hash browns. That's kind of how I felt.
See, to me, pancakes are either by themselves and they're like, all right, you're getting pancakes. It's got stuff on it. It's got all these things. And now I'm going to get like a side of bacon or a couple eggs on the side. To me, I don't double up on the carbs and go like all pancakes and then, hey, give me some fried potatoes with it. So to me, the potato hash brown side of it accompanies like the eggs and the bacon. So I think that's more one entity. I think pancakes or waffles are their own entity, and that bacon's kind of a side. Hash browns can be a side. But I think of that maybe a little bit differently than you do.
Rob, hit the music. 913-576-7610. It is time for Ask Mitch. People want to know about the victory lap last year with the Las Vegas Raiders. Was this a real thing? Was this something you guys talked about last year, the victory lap?
I don't know if it was a real thing and it happened. It got reported that it happened, so we assumed it did. And, you know, that's one of the rare kind of bulleted board material things that you know about. And that was a game I was very disappointed I didn't get to be part of, because in the locker room after that game and the trip back was, I heard, pretty awesome.
Sometimes it doesn't matter whether or not it happened if the team believes it. Like, the guys in the locker room believe that it happened. That's all that really matters, honestly. Like, what am I going to do with that information? Like, I'm not doing a better radio show because they did that, but I could have, like, if the bulletin board material, if that's what you need to get ready to play at your absolute best and you believe it's true, then it's true.
Yeah, I mean, that's the old Seinfeld, right? Costanza, just remember, Jerry, it's not a lie if you believe it's true. So yeah, as long as you believe it's the truth, and then once things get reported, I mean, they just quasi become facts anyway, so you just kind of assume it happened.
913-576-7610. Ask Mitch, which AFC West rival do you dislike the most?
The Raiders. I think, I don't know, it just seems like the most contentious. Their fans are the least respectful when we go there. It seems, I mean, they have a little bit more history than the other two as well. So I think they still think of themselves as, you know, the glory days and, you know, being what they were. And they were really happy with themselves after they beat us the first time and, you know, didn't hear much from them the rest of the year.
Do you have a black hole store?
Not really. I mean, they just, I don't know. I don't think the black hole is what it used to be. I mean, I kind of got built up, especially being in Los Angeles and, you know, knowing about the Raiders and all that stuff. And first time I went there, I just wasn't as impressed with it as what you see on NFL films.
That's like In-N-Out for me. Like, everybody hypes it up, and then I head in, and I was like, this is okay.
Well, you're wrong on that, but you also need to know what to order In-N-Out, so that's a whole other conversation.
That's my issue with In-N-Out is everybody that loves it like you always says there's a secret combination of things. Like, I don't have to do that at any other place where you got to know the secret password for the food to taste better. I don't get it.
No, it's two things. It's, well, on your burger, do you like raw onions or grilled onions?
I can do either one, but I'd probably pick raw onions.
Okay, so it comes with raw, so you don't have to change anything about your burger. And then the fries, all you have to do is order them well done. And then they give you salt with it because they don't want to oversalt it for people that don't like that. So you just add the salt that they give you. And the fries are awesome. That's the biggest thing people complain about, is the fries suck. Just order them well done and salt them with the salt they give you.
913-576-7610. What's your favorite thing to cook outside of barbecue?
Probably pizza, because that's kind of hands-on from the start. You know, I think pizza dough's a lot easier than people think it is. You get to, you know, play with your hands and throw the dough up in the air and do all these fun things. And, you know, pizza's totally customizable too, and it's kind of hard to screw up. So, you know, you can cook a steak and undercook it, overcook it, and, you know, kind of get frustrated that you kind of ruin this really good piece of steak. For the most part, you can't really screw up pizza, so you're always going to have something tasty.
Ask Mitch, which do you prefer playing against? A power rush or a power bull type rusher or a speed rusher?
I mean, for success, I'd rather go against the power guy, because that's typically easier to counter. For long-term health and safety, I'd rather go against the speed guy, so I just don't have to, like, you know, deal with a physical bull rush 40 times a game. But if I'm in a game week, I'd rather face the power guy. It's, you know, typically those guys aren't quite as explosive and don't worry you quite as much.
Who's your favorite power guy to go up against? Who's your favorite speed guy to go up against?
Favorite would be they suck at it. So anyone who sucks at it.
How about best matchups? Like, you know, going up against this guy, he's going to bring the best out of you every time you go up against him.
Well, those things change over time, which is the interesting thing, because, you know, at one point with the Chargers, for instance, like, I felt more comfortable blocking Bosa, Fish felt more comfortable blocking Ingram, and then, like, a year later, it was flipped, and we felt more comfortable blocking the other. So it's funny, because those things just constantly evolve over time. So it's hard to, you know, kind of pin those down, because earlier in my career, you know, I didn't have a sense of, you know, how to block a guy like Vaughn, and then over time, you kind of get used to it, and all right, I kind of understand what to do here, and then, you know, this other guy starts to become really frustrating.
Someone asked, how's your golf game? How far can you drive the ball? Right now, I imagine not a lot of golf playing with the back.
0 yards.
At one point, though, you were probably a golfer.
Yeah, I played like 3 to 5 times a year at most. I kind of purposely played so infrequently that I couldn't get frustrated on myself. You know, it seems like people get really pissed at themselves playing golf and start hating it. And so I just didn't want to play enough where I had any expectation. You know, I could go out. I've never shot better than 95 or 96 or whatever it is. So I'm not good. I know I'm not good. And I can go out, you know, have a couple nice drives in a round, enjoy those, and just be happy with it.
Who's the biggest or best golf guy on the team not named Pat? Because Pat, it's pretty clear that Pat enjoys playing golf. Who else is a big golf guy?
I think
guy?
Dieter's pretty big into it. He's pretty good. Kelsey can hit the ball a country mile and high as can be, far as can be. Doesn't always know where it's going, but he absolutely bombs it, which is no surprise. I think Kyle Long's pretty good at it, too. I think, you know, I've seen some stuff of him being a golfer, and I think he's got a lot of, you know, explosive ability there. So I think that he can hit the crap out of it.
According to Twitter right now, he's to figure out that whole Kansas versus Missouri side thing. That seems to be a big problem on his timeline right now.
Well, it's only a problem because people make it a problem. I don't think it's a problem for anyone who comes and lives here and is happily, you know, living in both states.
That is Mitchell Shorts joining us in studio for the 3 o'clock hour. Mitch, this is fun, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Coming up next, we will get into the Chicago White Sox drama with Tony La Russa. That's next. Keep it locked in right here. It's The Drive.